This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Sean Powers and I talk with Tim Pozar and Brian David, who are two brilliant broadcast engineers and talents and experienced dudes, about the transition from over-the-air broadcast as we've known it for like 100 years and all digital broadcast that any one of you can do at home as well. There's a lot of stuff in here, all kinds of products and all kinds of open source code that's in process. We had so much, we're going to have to continue the show at another time, but this is really good and it's coming up next.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 710, recorded Wednesday, December 7th, 2022. Open source for broadcast. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro from ACI Learning. IT Pro TV is now IT Pro from ACI Learning. If you're looking to break into the world of IT, or if your IT team needs to level up, get the introduction you need with IT Pro. Check out an IT Pro business plan by visiting itpro.tv/twit today. And by Code Comments, an original podcast from Red Hat that lets you listen in on two experienced technologists as they describe their building process and what they've learned from their experiences. Search for Code Comments in your podcast player. Hey, everybody. This is Doc Searles. I'm busy kind of writing the reality here because there's construction going on right outside that window, but that is not going to stop us. Sean Powers and I are here and ready to go. You there, Sean?
Somewhere I am.
In Michigan?
I'm here. You can't see. Oh, there I am. Yeah. Yeah, I'm here. Same place as always. The same office. Yeah. I never leave here. This is my prison. I mean, no, this is my office.
Yeah. You've regreened your hair.
I have, yeah. My daughter regreened it for me.
Oh, she did it. And she's still orange or some other matching
color?
She's
bright red now, and that was part of the motivation. Now we represent Christmas when we're near each other. So.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's cool. That's cool. Is it still snowing there?
No, it all melted. It all melted. Now it's just cold and miserable without any pretty snow. So, yeah.
I am in Los Angeles in a borrowed house that I'm seen on here from time to time. And I dragged you into this because none of our people know much about radio. I'm the guy, but you volunteered. So do you ever listen? Do you listen to the radio at all? I mean,
I do. I have a lot of thoughts about radio. I think maybe it's a good thing that I'm not like a radio professional, because I have an outside lot of questions that you may not think about. And so I'm looking forward to the conversation. My concern is that I might derail conversation because I want to know how things work and if there's a transitional way that we are going to go from, you know, the towers to the packets, and if that's a good thing, if it's a bad thing, if we shouldn't. I just want to have that conversation. So I'm here to offer outside insight.
We can start outside with that. So our guests today are Tim Pozar, who's been on the show before, and Brian David. Tim is, I met Tim, I think in 1995 or six, when he was not only, it was at like an ISP con or something, and he was running an ISP in San Francisco. At the same time, he was the chief engineer for a radio station that we listened to. And Brian is the chief engineer for KPFA. Legendary station in Berkeley. So welcome to the show, guys. This is the four-headed version of the show for those of you not visually impaired.
Was that a comment about my growing forehead?
It grows, it gets like this when it gets fully grown. So let's start with where Sean was going there, because and I'm an old radio guy. I'm old to begin with, and I've been into radio since I was a kid. I grew up looking at the towers of New York City's AM stations and riding down to them and talking to the chief engineers there, or the engineers that were stationed at the transmitters. The Meadowlands, they call it now, just bristled with towers. And I just go into these places and talk radio lore with these old guys. And now, of course, AM is almost gone, and FM, I think, may be on its way out too, though nobody talks about that, as radios turn into something that we listen to over packets. So where are we in that transition?
That's kind of funny you should ask, if you don't mind me jumping in on this.
Please do.
Back in, in 2005, I wrote a paper for the advisory board at Motorola, which I conveniently call 3G is a new standard broadcast band. We saw the move towards, or at least I saw it in the paper, the move towards pushing content over the net. And I, saw that driving down the road, you're not going to be pushing AM or FM on the buttons on your radio anymore. You're going to be opening up your phone and listening to a stream. And so that paper ended up going to Motorola, but it also modeled the... Oops, are we off?
Nope, we see you. I did.
We're on. I was on mute, but we were on. Carry on.
Oh, we lost.
Oh, sorry, now I'm back.
Oh, you're back.
That's weird.
Talking of packets.
I'm sorry. Yes.
It's this packet thing. Sometimes it works. Yeah. You get two or three nines of reliability. That. Yeah.
So, anyway, I saw people just basically, streaming content down the road. It's, you're not going to be pushing the AM or FM buttons anymore. You're going to be listening to it off your cell phone or whatever got built into your car. So with that, I was, in the paper, I looked at what QM would look like over the last several years, and it's been trailing off. And there's a paper that I think you sent, Doc, that or maybe it was Brian sent that showed that trend is still happening. We are not listening to over the air.
QM meaning cumulative listening. That's radio talk for over if a station has 100,000 QM, that's how many people listen in a given week. Right.
I was going to ask.
Sorry about
thank
the
you,
technical. But so people have these challenges, and Brian, still being in radio at this point, still has his challenge too. So I imagine he could probably talk about how are you delivering audio to your constituents now?
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a both and situation, right? We have an older listening audience, and the FM radio is something they love to hold and listen to all day, every day. And it gets reflected during fun drives with the comments and the listener feedback. And there's something intimate and personal to it. And there's something nostalgic. And it, in its like simple form, stands a test of time to many, although times change, everything changes. And so we do streaming. We have hundreds of people listening over our stream at any given time. And that grows as more people transition. At one point in time, the FM signal was also carried over cable TV carrier Comcast in the Bay Area. And so for the low valleys in the terrain where our signal couldn't reach, people could actually listen to FM over their cable subscription. So I think it has a place still, at least within Northern California, which was what I'm familiar with. But, there has to be an adaptation. And for a station like KPFA that's been around 73 years, that's a constant. There's a constant change there.
A few years ago, my son was now 26, he was 15. We got a little apartment in New York City, and we walked to Radio Shack because I wanted to get a radio for the kitchen. Radio Shack had no radios. it didn't have any radios.
And they don't even have a shack anymore.
Yeah, I don't even have a shack. No. And he said to me, not naively, I think, he said, what is the point of range and coverage? He didn't even know why is it okay that when you drive out of town, the station disappears? And a little while after that, his favorite station, which is WERS in Boston, which is where we had lived, did a cappella on weekends, a cappella music. And he loved a cappella music. And he was an a cappella guy. And when we started losing the station, he just plugged in his phone to the auxiliary input on the car. And we listened to it the rest of the way to New York. You mentioned, Brian, you have hundreds of streamers. Well, where there might be thousands of people still listening in their cars, mostly it's in cars now. Mm-hmm. But there So here's a technical question, and we can transition to the open source conversation. Can a station, like say a station has 500,000 listeners at a given time, it's a big one, really big one. Can they sustain 500,000 simultaneous streams? I have no idea, actually.
Well, I mean, I'm sure Icecast can. I'm sure there's a lot of tweaking, a lot of inode configuration, you know, bandwidth considerations. You know, I mean, if something like YouTube can deliver a billion or whatever, you know, why can't we with open source deliver the same quality or the same quantity? I think it's entirely possible. You know, I think there's kind of to the previous conversation around like leaving a city and entering or leaving a region and entering a new region and hearing something new. I think there's kind of something beautiful about letting go and moving on to something else and not always having access to the thing you want at all times. And so that's kind of at odds with our technical world too. And so FM as FM, not as FM as a stream, kind of holds that as well.
And so Icecast, I mean, I kind of know what Icecast is, but for those who may not, could you explain like the what Icecast actually does?
Sure. So it takes an audio feed, such as an MP3 or AAC or AUG or any kind of container, any codec, and adds in a buffer and distributes it over HTTP. And so you can listen to it, listen to an Icecast stream, which is just audio. It can also do video as well, though personally I've never done that. There's kind of it's been around a long time and has some limitations, and kind of a successor to it I'm seeing is HLS or HTTP live streaming, which we don't do at KPFA, but seems like a lot of stations have moved on to that, and that breaks things into smaller pieces and can chunk it out over like Nginx or a content distribution network or something like that.
Gotcha. Now, do you find, you brought up an interesting point about there's something beautiful about when you leave an area, you know, you leave the local focused content there or whatever. And I get that, but I feel like the globalization of communication, boy, I'm throwing out some words here, is kind of training us to gravitate towards things that we like. And I think, you know, possibly one of the difficulties that a local station might have, and this is kind of beyond the technical engineering part of it, but the talent part of it, trying to have local talking heads, for example, who are competing with something who's syndicated or somebody who's syndicated or a group of people who are syndicated who are amazingly talented in their like morning talk show, for example. I think it's tough to keep that local feeling when radio stations are almost required to pipe in this big name talent from who knows where in order to keep people listening. So I don't know if there's a way that we can keep that community vibe with, you know, an FM station, because I mean, that was kind of the whole point, you know, when you were in the area, you could listen to this station, but since that's not the case now, I don't know how we keep that charm, if you will. And I'm sure you don't have an answer, otherwise, you know, doing something, but that's something that I struggle with when it comes to radio stations.
If I could chime in and real quick on that, is that there is this thing called the Telecom Act of 1996 that basically pushed stations into more syndications. What happened was that ended up enabling a one company to be able to have more than one station in a market or more than a handful of stations. So they could get a majority of that. That ended up being this big, gigantic land rush for licenses. And so stations were horribly overpriced at that point. And because of that, they had to drop the operating expenses for running a radio station. That's when syndication, you know, the Howard Stern and the, you know, whatever else, you know, the various talk radios, that ended up being very nice and cost effective for being able to run a station. So you lost a lot of your local presence because of the Telecom Act of 1996. And you could see these stations now cratering, such as Clear Channel and Citadel and various other stations that are groups that have now gone bankrupt. We were looking at the cost of buying a license in San Francisco, and I was looking at one particular radio station, and probably about 10 years ago, that would have been $100 million to buy that license. Now it's probably around $5 million or so. So the cost has gone down considerably, but people are still having to pay off this debt that they had when they first bought these stations.
Oof, and it's far cheaper cheaper and easier to scale a digital alternative to that. So that's painful.
So anyway, hopefully that answered your question about local programming.
Yeah.
Brian's station, KPFA, is notorious for having lots of local programming and such. And so they have some costs that they have to work with. And Brian could probably address this better than I can, but there's a lot of volunteers, but they still, producing local programming is costly. You have to pay staff, you have to pay for studios, researches, all the other stuff that to cover.
And so part of the model is like, we're a nonprofit station, and without advertisements, we've been listener supported 100%. We get very little in terms of grants or foundational funding. And it's always been that way. I believe we're the first, or one of the first, really, to start that. And there's an aspect there that is different when we start to break down FM into commercial stations or non-commercial stations. And I guess personally, I see room for the non-commercial stations to survive because they're not chasing profits as much as sustainability and quality. And so there's kind of a different direction, not necessarily interested in scale, so to speak. And so we can grow or we can shrink as a station because our focus is a little more on that local, the local content and making connections. And our studios in the heart of Berkeley, pre-COVID, were open for people to come and share. And it was a little more of a social center as well. So I think there's aspects that go beyond the technical and into the community relations aspect that makes something like FM unique. Whereas I don't know, I've never been to like a community event in a data center. I don't know if it's how great that is.
I want to dig deeper, and I think because we're at this transition point between over-the-air broadcast and kind of a crossover point where between over-the-air broadcast and digital broadcasting, and I think on the far side of that, especially around community stuff and around narrow interests of one kind or another, there's a whole other breed that's actually going to thrive on open source, and you guys are working a lot on that. And I want to get to that after I let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro. IT Pro TV is now IT Pro from ACI Learning. Your IT team needs the skills and knowledge to ensure your business is a success. And with IT Pro, more than 80% of users who start a video actually finish it. IT Pro is engaging, and your team will enjoy learning on their platform. Give your team the tools they need to make your business thrive. Courses are entertaining and binge-worthy, keeping your team interested and invested in learning. The tech industry is evolving, changing rapidly, and your team needs to be trained today. When a new software release, system upgrade, or cyber threat faces your business, IT Pro offers the training and perspectives of those disruptions within days, if not hours. So why is IT Pro right for your business? Well, get all training and certifications for your team done all in one place. IT Pro has every vendor and skill you need for your IT team training. They provide Microsoft IT training, Cisco training, Linux training, Apple training, security, cloud, and so much more. More than 6,800 hours worth, ranging from technical skills to compliance to soft skills. You can do so much more with an IT Pro business plan, track your team's results, manage your seats, assign and unassign team members, and access monthly usage reports. You can see metrics like logins, viewing time, tracks completed, and more. You can easily manage teams, manage subsets of users or teams by providing them with customized assignments, monitoring progress, and reporting on usage of the platform. Assignments can be full courses and or individual episodes within courses. Advanced reporting is another one. Get immediate insight into your team's viewing patterns and progress over any period of time with visual reports. And don't forget that IT Pro has individual plans too. IT Pro from ACI Learning. Give your team the IT development platform they need to level up their skills while enjoying the journey. Go to itpro.tv/twit today. Okay, so Tim and Brian, you provided us with a lot of material, which I've been going through. Basically, what it says to me is, you can do a lot. You can do broadcast on your own with a small group for nothing, engineering wise, other than equipment, using open source stuff. So, do you want to kind of give us the outline on that and walk us through it?
Well, I think that the need ended up with Brian. The reason I wanted Brian on this is that you're in Pittsburgh? What time?
Yeah, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh, yeah.
Wow.
So the chief engineer of Pittsburgh is located in Pittsburgh. KPFA is in Berkeley.
You're not up on Whiskey Peak fixing the transmitter on the weekends?
No. Fortunately, we have a transmitter supervisor there. You know, 1 hour a week just to make sure things are good.
So the challenge that he has is how do you keep running a radio station from that distance? I mean, he keeps coming in. So I was very impressed with what Brian has done in making this available so that he can operate pretty much any aspect of the station from Pittsburgh. Part of this. I don't know if we go down in kind of script order that we have here, but part of this is making sure that we have appropriate monitoring, a lot of this stuff came out of like the data center, the network kind of model of things. And so we're using things like, or at least KPFA is, and I've been using this for other companies that I use, an open source product called Libre NMS. And the nice thing about it is, one, it knows all about your network devices, but with little tweaking that like Brian has done, and I hopefully chimes in here a little bit, is I'll let him, is it can actually poke at things like, you know, your transmitter, your forward power, your reverse power, you know, the reflected power, you know, all sorts of aspects of day-to-day station operation. So Brian, what do you use it for monitoring? How do you use it for specifically for broadcast?
Yeah, there was an interesting transition. Thanks, Tim. So around two years ago, maybe a little more, time gets a little funky. COVID was starting and we really needed to have our hosts continue broadcasting, but remotely. The studios, it became a concern to have many people inside one building. And we said, okay, let's take a look at how to do that. And being somewhat familiar with codecs and protocols, I said, like, okay, we can set up some software or some hardware at people's home, and they can come in remotely over the board and make a high quality real time phone call. And additionally, there was things like meter readings, which people were taking by hand, which was something I inherited when I joined. And said, okay, let's see if we can log this, if we can automate this process a bit, so that way I can just get alerted or people can be alerted if there's an issue and we have an audit trail. And Libre NMS, Tim put me onto it, and I said, oh, wow, this is great. Not only can we monitor all of the switches and the routers and our primary links and our backup links, but we can also monitor power and battery life and levels. If we just make a little connection from a MIB, a manufacturer's information base, don't quote me on that one, like the object ID from SNMP data, simple network messaging protocol. And so the data from a lot of our devices was able to go into Libre NMS with a lot of tweaking. And then we, then I and the engineering team can receive alerts from that. And so, and additionally, we started to alert ourselves on Slack, and then we can create actions on Slack to resolve things like our archiver file is not archiving correctly, or our primary transmitter is having an issue. And it created a much more domain awareness of the station than previously I had. And it was fabulous in terms of training others within our station on how these interconnected systems work.
If there's a screenshot, I think it's a Libre NMS 02. Actually, the next one from that one. That one. That's KPFA's dashboard. And I notice it, and the alerts there, the syslog entries there, that he's monitoring his streams, showing, you know, if there's an up down condition or, you know, people connecting and such. What else do you have on that dashboard there?
So we have a primary transmitter in Grizzly Peak. We have our studios in Berkeley. Then we have translators in Monterey and Santa Cruz and North Peak Diablo. There's a repeater. And so all of those sites, I'm aware of what's going on the transmitter, on the receiver, on the STL link, studio transmitter link, on the IP backup links, and can get alerted or notified if there's any issue in connectivity, if it's temporary, if it's permanent.
Yeah, that's a shot of the transmitter power out.
So this is our, we're monitoring forward power, reflected power. We have monitoring for our auxiliary transmitter. And so just yesterday, we started Fun Drive, and also there was a tower crew climbing our tower to do an inspection. And so, you know, we dropped off the air for a few seconds as we transitioned from primary to auxiliary, and I just received notice, and it was expected, and life continued on. And then I can see at any point in time when that transition happened. I could also make a note of when that transition happened. And so it's become the primary station log as well.
So I have a nerdy question about the graphic that was just up there. Are the various transmitters, the backhaul to them, is that all, you said one is a repeater. Do they get the radio signal via radio signal, or is there an IP backend that feeds them all? How does that actually get sent from transmitter to transmitter or repeater to repeater to keep your signal the same everywhere?
Yeah, so we do it in a couple ways. And so from our studio, we generate the audio, and we call it program audio. And then there's a 15-second delay, because saying a curse word would be the end of the world. At least the FCC says so. From there, it goes over a microwave link on 950 megahertz called a studio transmitter link. And that's just transmitting digital audio from our studios to our transmitter site, about 3 miles away. And that also carries a small low bandwidth, like 1 megabit per second link. But in addition to that, we have point-to-point, like 2 Ubiquiti dishes that do about a gigabit of bandwidth between the two sites. So that's our backup IT link.
But so, the main one is over the 9-something megahertz?
Or 950 megahertz radio. Yeah, there's a lot of radio in radio.
But that's a better quality, audio quality than, you know, converting to something and pushing it over gigabit, you know, point-to-point stuff?
Well, it's a licensed band on our studio transmitter link. So that little pathway for the radio is restricted use just for us. So, and it's a digital stream, so there's no audio loss.
Oh, it is digital. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And from there, we have translators and repeaters. So translators are things that take our broadcast signal on 94.1 and push it out on a different frequency, like 97.5. And that's just over the air. So there's a receiver that receives 94.1 and then pipes it directly to a transmitter, and then that pushes it out on 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and at a lower wattage. Like, I think we're like 10 watts ERP there. And so that allows people to listen to our station, KPFA, on a different frequency, because our main signal doesn't reach down because of the geography in the valley. So that is a direct off the air and into a transmitter. And so there doesn't have to be any IP link at all. We just need a good solid receive antenna.
Cool. So it's a combination of all the various things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's another one called an inner city relay, which goes to our booster site. And so that's also a microwave link that sends digital audio from point A to point B. It's very similar to an STL. In fact, I couldn't tell you the difference really, other than it's from transmitter to transmitter.
The other image that you saw, that got thrown up there, with kind of the links going between the different mountaintops. That is a sample of what, yeah, thank you. That's a network that actually Bonneville Broadcasting uses, and this is one I put together, which their main station is at Sutro in the middle of San Francisco. We have an 11 gigahertz link that goes between there and Vollmer Peak, which is actually quite very close to where KPFA is. And then from there it goes to Rocky Ridge and then to Wiedemann Hill, which is, you know, next to San Ramon and such. Those are that's all just using 11 gigahertz digital radios and Juniper switches and such. But they link all these transmitter sites up together so that they can transmit at exactly the same timing. So they all buffer together so they don't interfere with each other. This is one way of sort of distributing radio and trying
so
to cover
all
these little areas.
They're all pushing the same frequency, the same radio frequency?
Well, they're all on the same frequency, and you have to line them up so that the audio lines up at exactly the same time when they get broadcast, so you don't have interference with
weird ghosting. And okay,
yeah. So the idea is that it's supposed to be covering like little valleys, and you know, like there's a little valley in Orinda that they're trying to fill in, and so you use these, Gates makes these boxes, called Gates Air links, that will actually delay everything by maybe like 100 milliseconds or so, or maybe several seconds, and then make sure that they all broadcast at the exact same time, that way. So that they have this built-in buffer in it.
So, and please correct me if my comprehension here is incorrect, but how do you make the decision to do something like that versus the repeat on a different station? Because I mean, I see that, you know, the repeat on a different station all over up here. You know, I mean, I live in rural northern Michigan. And so, you know, a station will have like they have a term for sister state. I don't even know what they call it, but you know, where it's the same station, but on a different frequency. How do you make that decision versus, you know, this, you know, intricate timing so you can actually keep one frequency in multiple locations?
Well, there's various rules and regulations that allow you to do translators versus boosters. Boosters are on frequency. So if you're like KPFA and your main transmitter is 94.1, then your boosters all have to be at 94.1. Translators will show up at any frequency on the band. And so if you find that, for instance, if you go down to, say, Santa Cruz, and if you put a booster on the air at 94.1, you may actually interfere with yourself because you may have enough leakage from your main signal, but it may, albeit maybe a little weak. So you may decide, well, you know what? There's a frequency over here that I can put a translator on. And so you make a decision to do a translator instead. Boosters are a little tricky too. Well, as I said, because they're on the same frequency. So you really need to have a very isolated community that's not picking up the regular signal. My last station that I was at, which was at 103.7 up on Sutro, we had a bunch of boosters, one at Wiedemann and one at what was called Baroni's. There's a reasonably good mountain range that's between the bowl of the Bay Area and the East Bay. And so there was enough isolation that we were able to put a booster there and be able to cover Walnut. Well, it was actually more like Concord, because they really couldn't get our signal from our signal on Sutro Tower.
I want to jump in here for a second to say this is just catnip for me because I love it. the interesting thing is if you go east of the Rockies, there's not a lot of what's called terrain shadowing. There are no mountains. I mean, there are in the Appalachians, there are in New England, but for the most part, the Bay Area is really special in the sense that nothing on Mount Sutro in San Francisco or San Bruno, which is next to San Francisco, gets very well into the East Bay. And almost all the stations have boosters up on Mount Diablo. I don't know if yours is on Mount Diablo or not, but they're actually you probably don't need the one on Mount Diablo because KPFA is on the ridge that isolates San Francisco from the East Bay. So it's advantaged that way. An interesting thing to me is that it's really important to have all that stuff working, but I want to be able to get down through all this other stuff you guys are working on. Cause I'm wondering.
Shut up, Sean.
I'm not saying that at all.
Let's try to go for the open source and broadcast desert thing. It sounds like that's
right.
Kind of the bit for the show. Well, so we talked about monitoring, and the next thing that Brian started having to do is how to get an automation. So you need some sort of automation. You need some way of being able to play back your programming, your music, whatever. There's going to be times where either it's going to be a syndicated feed, or the person can't show up, or you have overnights where nobody may be staffing the station. So once upon a time, if you tried to buy an automation system for a broadcast station, it was going to be tens of thousands of dollars, if not more, because you had to go out and buy specialized hardware and specialized cards, and then you had to buy their software, and they charge you an arm and a leg to pay for support on these things and stuff. And there's been a number of attempts to come up with automation software. There was a Christian broadcasting group that developed this software called Rivendell, and they wanted to do it for all their little, you know, little radio stations that they had. So Rivendell came about. Doesn't look as neat as the other ones we're about to show you, but Rivendell will run under Linux. It runs under X, and you can actually run it on a Raspberry Pi. So I actually have two LPFM. Or small little radio stations that are licensed at my house. And that's what drives that. I have a Raspberry Pi and thanks for the Rivendell pointer there. I think there's actually a Rivendell screenshot too that I have in there as well, that you can see what the GUI of it looks like. But that is a great low cost because it's free. I could run it on a Raspberry Pi. And I could just sort of throw it in the corner. And so my whole, you know, CapEx was, $100 for the Pi and another $100 for a drive that I put my music on. And then of course, yeah, there's the transmitter and the antenna and such. So it was relatively low cost. Yeah. There's my screenshot of my, for KPEALP. This is probably about a year ago when I was running this. So you can see the legal ID there, and then the music that's being played and such. So I think David could probably talk, or Brian could talk about the, Libre Time.
Yeah. So Libre Time is similar to Rivendell, except it runs in a web browser. So that makes it accessible to your DJs, to hosts, to your like media manager or traffic coordinator, and it allows for you to make a schedule, and there's screenshots that show this. So you can put in your whole station schedule. That's kind of the dashboard, the opening page, where we have 12 to 1 is this show, and then a legal ID for 2 minutes. This is a screenshot of our grid for KPFA. And we use this as our backup audio, actually, because we do a lot of transitions inside the studio. But if our studio ever goes off the air for whatever reason, this just comes from our our Linux container in our data center in Fremont. And it's been a great program to work with over the years. It was originally called Airtime from a company called Source Fabric. And they were making it open source, but stopped developing it around 2013. And then it was picked up by the community. It was forked and development continued. And it allows you to upload audio. It allows you to upload a podcast for automatic ingestion. So if you wanted, let's say like Democracy Now!, you could take their RSS feed, you could put it in Libre Time, and it would automatically download and be scheduled in that block. You can also do things called smart blocks, which allow you to create a formula for what you want to play, be it some criteria, some condition, you know, for X amount of time or for X amount of shows that start with, you know, the word Bajaba. And so you can get creative and constructive. And so you can start to build automation around your station's flow, what you want it to sound like, when you want it to sound like what, if users need to log in and upload content directly. And it also allows for live broadcasting. You can use a tool called Butt, broadcast using this tool, and stream directly into Libre Time. And that will then stream out to either your terrestrial radio, if it's hooked up to FM, or to your listeners on the web stream that it generates. So it's a well-developed, flexible, open source, and free tool that's seen a lot of attention actually in the last year to bring it up to version 3, which has been pretty exciting. And I'm super appreciative of that because it had some kinks and quirks along the ride. But right now it's much more polished. And this is something people can just install and go. You know, they can run it on a Raspberry Pi. They can run it in a Linux container or a virtual machine or Docker. And it can output a web stream. It can output audio over an audio interface device. And it works great to manage audio and to schedule and to have users be able to contribute as well, or DJs, you know. Yeah.
You mentioned Liquid Soap here too, in our script and such. How does that, what is that? Is that kind of an underlying language for Libre Time, or how does that work?
It's the Kung Fu. It's really, Liquid Soap's a scripting language. I believe it's actually, its language is OCaml, which was a little challenging to learn a bit, but Liquid Scope's a program and a programming language that's also open source, and it's for audio and video. And so here in this screenshot, we see KPFA, it's a script, that we run, and we're taking various sources. Like we're taking 5 different audio sources and creating conditions. If this has silence or audio below this level for 15 seconds, then fail over to the next one, and so forth and so on. And so you can create multiple paths of redundancy through a script. You can also transform the audio and raise the gain or lower the gain. You can add effects, you can add transitions, you can add schedules. So Libre Time is like a graphical front end for Liquid Soap, which is the underlying kind of processing and scheduling and audio maneuvering. And so learning Liquid Soap, which there's great docs and the developers themselves are really friendly and available to just chat with on Slack. So that was, and there's tutorials on YouTube. And so for someone like me, this is super exciting to have access to people and free resources and to learn with others and share. I think they call them recipes, Liquid Soap recipes, of how to do certain things. So you can transport, you can record, you can schedule, you can mix. You could put a live stream on YouTube if you wanted to, with video overlay content. And it's all programmatic.
Should we go into the other subject areas, or
no? Speaking of code, Doc.
Yeah, I feel the construction outside the window. Actually, I mean, as a way of sort of going, you have a huge outline of tools here. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, my fantasy here is that a listener or two or a few will want to get into this. You know, like, mm-hmm. When the idea of starting a radio station when I or we were coming up was, oh, this is going to cost, tens of thousands, hundreds or millions of dollars, when in fact it may, the cost is, a server, IceCast or whatever, whatever system you use to get it out to a large number of people. But to produce stuff live and account for it and pay royalties, I imagine some of these tools account for that. You're playing music selections and the way it's worked since the DMCA in 1998, you have to, unlike with broadcast radio, is different, but for streaming, you have to keep track of not only how many people are listening, but exactly what you played, and then you pay a royalty on a per performance, it's called, basis. And that takes some software, right? But it's available. You have a whole list of stuff here. So what's the threshold of getting started? And let's organize this a bit by saying, okay, if I'm starting one, what do I go down this list and want first and then play it out?
I would say Libre Time. Libre Time, you can install on a very low powered, has very low resources, and get started. It's going to be intuitive. It drag and drop some music, start putting it in a block, which then you put on a time, and now you have music at a certain time. That's radio. Or you want to chime in with your voice, you can connect with your mic to your Libre Time server and start, composing your vocal arts all over the air. So it's a great beginner tool, and it works well even for a station like ours, where we can lose the whole studio, which at times in the past, that would be the heart of everything, and immediately pick back up elsewhere. So it's very versatile. There's great user docs. Great time.
So I'm curious a little bit, and maybe you can point me in the right direction. You mentioned that you have a low power FM station, plural, Brian, or no, Tim, you do. For a person who wanted to play with this, I mean, obviously streaming on the internet's the quote unquote free, nothing's free, but the free way to go. It's possible to do both eventually, though. I mean, there are like even license free low power FM stuff that a person could do if they wanted to like narrate their Christmas lights that are outside, I think, correct? So,
yes.
I mean,
yeah, there's what's called Part 15, which enables you to be able to do, you can run a little transmitter at a very, very low power that, again, will get you around a couple blocks. In fact, as you point out, I was just visiting my family in Pacific Grove, and there's this guy that just does this amazing Christmas display, and you tune into 107.9, I think, or something like that, to listen to the music with it.
Yeah,
are you specifically asking what it would take to get on the air?
Yeah, no, that was my question. I knew that there was a way you could do something low power without worrying about licensing, and so yeah, that was
sure. Yeah, the next step up would be to try to get an LPFM license that gets you a legal licensed radio station that you can go up to 100 watts, and that actually will get you around. With stations as they are right now, I don't know if you can. The next step up would be purchasing a license. I don't know if there's many other frequencies available at this point to start your own. I think that heyday is over. From the 70s and such, when we were able to put on stations, like I helped start a station that rebroadcast KPFA called KFCF in Fresno. But that was in 1974, and all those frequencies are pretty much used up at this point.
I'm hurrying to look here and see what's available in Petoskey, Michigan for Sean. and maybe you could look it up. There's a thing called radio-locator.com. Put in your It was started by some guys at MIT a long time ago. It's a really cool service. It'll show you what's in any given location. But first, I have to, before we go into the rest of this, let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Code Comments, an original podcast from Red Hat. You know, when you're working on a project and you leave behind a small reminder in the code, a code comment, to help others learn from your work, this podcast takes that idea by letting you listen in on two experienced technologists as they describe their building process. There's a lot of work required to bring a project from whiteboard to development, and none of us can do it alone. The host, Burr Sutter, is a Red Hatter and a lifelong developer advocate and community organizer. In each episode, Burr sits down with experienced technologists from across the industry to trade stories and talk about what they learned from their experiences. I should say, by the way, I do subscribe to Code Comments. It's a really good show. The one on deep learning I was listening to today, and it has to do, among other things, with how do you do recognizing of people and learning about them, not individually, but as, for example, customers wandering through a store without seeing their faces or while completely anonymizing them so you can get intelligence about what's going on. It's really cool stuff, and it's really interesting to see how far companies will go to try and protect privacy while doing deep learning. So episodes are available anywhere you listen to podcasts and at redhat.com/codecommentspodcasts. Search for Code Comments in your podcast player. We'll also include a link in the show notes. My thanks to Code Comments for their support. So where were we? we were in LPFM, and I was thinking of your town, Sean. We could actually look at that later if we want. There's a In smaller towns, there generally is some leeway there. And sometimes translators get abandoned by stations, and that those could be LPFM frequencies. Does that happen much, guys? You see that happening?
I see translators are usually supported by a main station or boosters and such. So usually those are more of a more value. I think LPFMs are the ones that I'm really concerned about. And there's groups like Common Frequency and Prometheus Radio and such that are really trying to make sure that LPFMs are there and they're supported by the community. What has happened in the past is these groups will usually hook up a nonprofit to these things, and then the nonprofit doesn't realize on what it actually takes to produce 24 hours of programming a day. There are solutions to that, and we're going to talk about that a little bit here, to how to keep those stations on the air and still serve the community. So I think that it's actually LPFMs are actually in more danger of disappearing because of lack of skill or knowledge how to operate these things.
So what? I can't believe that I'm actually talking about this. I'm an IP person. I mean, networking is my trade. Oh no, my video is not working. It is locked up. Can you hear me though?
Yeah, we can hear you.
This is my ventriloquism act, and I have been practicing. So
you need to do the clutch cargo thing, you know, where your lips just move, and that's it.
All right, so yeah, you can have somebody else's gorgeous face on the screen while I'm talking. But I'm curious, what kind of hardware is required for this? Because I'm shockingly kind of like curious about low power FM. Obviously, looking briefly here at the FCC stuff, it has to be a nonprofit. But what kind of costs are we talking about to do that? I mean, you have two in your home, but they're because you don't want them to go away.
Right. Well, and I just happen to be somebody who's had broadcast experience for many, many years. I mean, I started in broadcasting in 74. So I happen to have a pile of junk here that I could throw these sort of things together with. There are certain restrictions. You have to, you still have to participate in what's called, EAS or the emergency alerting, system out there. So you have to go out and buy that gear. That's not cheap. You have to have a transmitter, and it has to be approved for LPFM operation. So Broadcast Warehouse and a couple other companies make these transmitters that are approved by the FCC or used for LPFMs. The FCC is making the assumption that the people who are operating LPFMs don't have a lot of technical skill, or they may not have somebody who's like a transmitter engineer that can make sure that, you know, things stay on frequency and you're not running too much power, too little power, you're doing all the right things. So they really are trying to bulletproof it as much as they can. So some of this you may have to go out and buy new. Having a modulation monitor is handy. It's not required necessarily, but it's good to have one of those things. There's a company called Innovonics that's in Santa Cruz or Bonnie Doone that makes these things. You can usually find these things on eBay as well. And if you buy something, I would send it into them, have them calibrate it, and get it back to you. So there's some responsibility of doing this. Then what we're talking about in the open source list here are all the packages that it would do to be able to get the audio to the transmitter. So that's all cheap. In fact, I'm going to touch on this a little bit, the fact that how do you come up with content? If you go to the very bottom of that sort of script that I gave you, there's a thing called, I mentioned open content for programming. If you go to a website called www.radioforall.net, this is a project, a bit of an anarchistic project that happened, or started about 20 years ago. And these are various communities. These are content providers that will put, produce shows, and then, put these up on this website that I actually help maintain. And then, there's an RSS feed on this thing, and you can start plugging this into your automation, start downloading this stuff. And most of this is free. It's music content or news content. If you can see at the very bottom there, it says the children's hour. So there's kids programming there. And they come out typically once a week or so. And so this is one way you can at least start taking some of this content. There's other content out there like Democracy Now!, which you probably heard of Amy Goodman and broadcasts out of New York City. And if you talk to her, she'll give you the content for free as well. So there's ways to get a lot of this content, but that means that you are pulling content from other parts of the country and you're not doing local content. Mm-hmm. So that's usually the part that's a little bit more work. As you know, producing a show like basically takes some time to find the talent and and put together the show. You have the same problem in putting together an hour radio show. It may take you 6 hours of time to go out and find the talent and do the interviews and then edit it to make a half an hour show. So there's a bit of overhead, but to get at the very basic, you could probably start pulling content from places like Radio for All and get on the air. My LPFMs that I have are, because they're kind of placeholders, I'm playing back not only Democracy Now!, but the Children's Hour, but I'm also playing back music. But I'm finding music that is not copyrighted or it's out of copyright, or I don't have to worry about royalties and such. So if you want to hear 1924 78s, I have half my day is that. And then the other half of my day is content that has fallen out of copyright. So if you go to the Internet Archive, you'll see there's an archive on Internet Archive called Unliked Recordings. And these are recordings that people have not re-upped the copyright on. And so I'm pulling that down and playing those back at this point. Now, I have to be very careful because I have to make sure that the composers are also dead, you know, and they've been dead for like, you know, 70 years or something like that. So that limits the music that I can do. It's not the 78s, to mainly like classical music and such. That would be the other half of the day that I program. So this is all the ways you can sort of get around doing things on the cheap.
So are the rules different then for, like, you know, I'm a content creator, and so, you know, music is always an issue when it comes to licensing. But things like Stream Beats, for example, is a huge collection of audio that is free to use for live streaming. But are the rules different when it comes to actually broadcasting on the radio?
No, there's fair use, and then there's public domain music that you're probably using with StreamBeats, or there may be some licensing. There may be Creative Commons licensing where you can take that and be able to rebroadcast it and such. So, but most, if it's not licensed under, if somebody created something, it's automatically under copyright.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, so you have to, you have to respect that. You also have to, you know, and figure out how you're going to be able to put that on the air. It may be encumbered with royalties. So it may be licensed under, again, the big three, where, you know, BMI, CSCAP, and ASCAP, and where you're going to have to pay the royalties on that. So I'm purposely looking for stuff that is outside, not part of those royalties, the houses, and also that the composer has been dead for 70 years. So you can get away with, you know, music like that.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Go ahead, Sean.
No, I was going to say, I just looked at the specifics, because StreamBeats is designed specifically so people don't have to pay royalties. However, in their fine print, it's only for online streaming of live user things on YouTube, Twitch, yep. Blah, 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 blah. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Terms of service.
Mm-hmm. So it's you're effectively doing the same thing like you would do for stock photos or something like that. There's conditions on that that you can only use it for certain things. So I doubt it, you may not be able to use it for the content that you see on Radio for All, where that's going to go out to regular radio stations.
Hmm. You know, I'm familiar with Creative Commons licensing for photographs and for artwork, but not for music. Does Creative Commons apply to music as well?
Yeah,
I assume it
can. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
we are, go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, it's, yeah.
It no, I'm just saying we're close to the end of the show. So I want to, we have to get into a wrap. I hate to say it.
Oh, okay.
But we're
well, sometime
pretty close to an hour.
We could talk about all the other things like audio editing software and things like that.
there's so much, and I'm thinking we need to get the capsule version of your outline there that we tried to go by. An hour isn't long enough, and that may mean that we have to have you back soon.
Sure. Or you could publish what we sent you as well.
Yeah, okay.
It depends on the licensing.
Yeah. Let me make sure it's attribution only or something like that. This has been great. There are so many ways that I wish we had time to go into, because it's terribly interesting. And I think we're at this interesting moment, that liminal moment between one state and another, where both are still there. It's pretty strong stuff. So we always close with two questions, which are four questions for you guys, I guess. what's your favorite scripting language and text editor?
Oh, sorry, Vim. Or people got Vim. It's VI for me. That's what I've just. I grew up on. Sorry. Sorry, all you Emacs fans out there.
Both of them. Both of the.
Everybody I know who's from the East Coast is Emacs. And of course, I grew up in California, so it's VI for me. And then the other it would be scripting. I like Bash a lot. Why do I have to run a rather heavyweight interpreter every time I want to do something? And Batch is actually pretty flexible. You can do a lot with it. So, yep.
Brian Fox on the show a few months ago, too, talking about that. He's one of the primary Batch guys. So Brian, how about you? You mentioned a scripting language among the broadcast tools. So,
yeah. While I do certainly appreciate Liquid Soap for its flexibility, it's been a challenge to learn. So I'm going to go with Tim on Bash. It's nice. It's simple. It's straight to the point. And then I'm going to also be a plain Jane and say, I use Nano. I use Nano for so much. It's just in and out is how I feel about it. And sometimes I like the struggle. I like being limited in what I can do. And appreciate that. So there's an emotional relationship to it.
That's great. That's great. Well, guys, it has been awesome having you on the show. And I wish we had more time. But Ann said ahead of time, it's going to go fast. And I wanted to make sure we covered everything and we couldn't. But that's a great tease for the next time we do it. So we'll have to have you back for that. Thanks for being on the
show. Thanks, Doc.
Yeah, thanks, Doc. Yep. Thanks, Sean. Thanks, Tim.
So, Sean, does this tempt you to start an LPFM in your town or with the schools you work with or anything like that? Or just get a stream going or neither?
In the same way that I always want to try the nerdy thing that we learn about when we're on the show, right? Coming up with programming, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Yeah, it's going to be giant playlists, and there's probably a different word than playlists in the radio world. But it's cool. I kind of want to try it. I'm going to look into the low power FM stuff just to see like what's involved. But it's hard to
set up. I can see him.
It's hard to not just opt for a streaming service, right? Because it's tough. You almost have to think of it as a locale-based thing, because if you just think of it as a way to transmit information or data, then it's better served by IP. And I think that's kind of not the point of the low-power FM. So
I think, Sean, you get it. Actually, to cut in a little bit, that's that's the point of connection, and that maybe IP, it's an abstraction even further. Like as technology progresses, we become more abstracted from the source material, where with a radio, you still might have a telephone number to call in and talk to the host and you may never see each other. So there's also kind of this anonymity to being like a radio personality that also you can feel connected to. And then possibly if you meet the person, it shatters your dreams because they're a hero and all heroes disappoint. There's just a lot kind of going on in this like interpersonal dynamic and sort of the simplicity with FM, or especially with low power FM, where it's like your block, your neighborhood, it re-engages that question and that connection of what am I offering and what are people receiving in a much more direct way. And it's not, my 10 million followers. I'm not an influencer. It's, I might see this person, they might hear me, we might not know each other kind of question when you walk down the street. And to me, there's something that feels like a humanistic to that I personally appreciate. So it's a different kind of engagement than pushing packets and bandwidth and traffic and kind of these like quantitative metrics that sometimes in tech we get swooped up in.
Well, that's great, and that's bonus content, as they say. So Sean, it's plug time. So what do you want to plug? You're all over video.
My new radio station. So I feel bad saying
Sean
like,
is coming
hey,
along.
In this, yeah. As we talk about radio, be sure to check out my YouTube stream. Just my link down there, SeanPowersWithAZero.com. That's a link to all my stuff. If you're curious more about me, that's where all my stuff is.
Sean has a massive amount of content on YouTube and elsewhere, and he did lots and lots of that for Linux Journal back in the decade or the decades. And he's good at it. He wasn't green then. He was still some other color. I forget it now. I can only remember green. For those of you listening, Sean has green hair now. Anyway,
it's true.
This has been great. And I am supposed. Next week I believe we have Bruce Perens lined up, but I'm not sure. But Bruce Perens, hugely important guy in the history of open source, but he wants to talk space. So that is coming up next week if we're on schedule, and if not, it'll be somebody else's great too. So that's how it works. So thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Hey there, I'm Micah Sargent. Look, as a geek myself, I feel it's only fair if I admit something. We can be kind of hard to shop for. So what do you get for that geek in your life who has everything already? Well, a Club Twit gift subscription, of course. Twit podcasts keep them informed and entertained with the most relevant tech news podcasts available. With a Club Twit subscription, they're going to get access to all of our podcasts ad-free, exclusive outtakes, behind-the-scenes and special content, and I love this, exclusive shows like my own Hands on Mac and Hands on Windows from Paul Thurrott, as well as the Untitled Linux Show. So purchase your geek's gift at twit.tv/clubtwit, and they will thank you every day.